It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, and happy tax day, April 15th. Hope you have your returns in, or at least have your extensions in place. And for our first thought today, Crain's New York business columnist Greg David has a thought about how President Trump's tax reform, in effect for the first time this tax day, has made the job of winning harder for the Yankees and the Mets and the Nets, who are in the playoffs, and the Islanders, who are in the playoffs, and who else am I leaving out, and other New York sports teams by raising taxes on New York relative to other states. Greg David writes, with the help of an analysis by the Partnership for New York City, here's how to follow the money. First, you have to understand that pro athletes pay what is known as the jock tax. They pay state and local income taxes to states that have such taxes for every day they play, that is, work there. If the Yankees play a four-game series in Los Angeles, Aaron Judge's salary for those 4 days is taxed by California. He gets to deduct those taxes from what he owes New York. If the Yankees play in Florida or Texas, he does not get that credit because those states have no income tax, unquote. In other words, it could be harder now to attract big name, big talent free agents to sign with the New York teams because their tax deductions will be limited by Trump here more than in other states. That's the first thing today. As for Trump's own tax return, the Democratic Congress wants the public to be able to get a look at it, right? And as Trump continues to claim he can't release them while he's under audit, here's a short but revealing moment from a House Appropriations Committee hearing last week in which Congressman Matt Cartwright of Pennsylvania asks IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig a simple question.
But there's no rule that would prohibit the release of a tax return because it's under audit.
I'm not aware of such a rule.
Oh, he didn't want to say that, but he had to say it because that was the only answer. He wasn't aware of such a rule prohibiting the release of tax returns that are under audit. And with that, we welcome our first guest, NPR national politics reporter Mara Liasson. Thanks for doing this, Mara. Happy tax day.
Happy tax day to you.
And welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. What's
the latest on the request for the tax return and the White House or IRS response?
Well, the White House does not want to turn over Trump's tax returns. As a matter of fact, the chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, has said this is not going to happen. The president has been saying, I would be fine to turn them over if I wasn't under audit, and I'm under audit. What we don't know is whether that's true or not. How long does an audit take? We know that presidents' tax returns are automatically audited. We know that. Every president gets his tax return audited. But what we don't know is how long it takes to audit that tax return. So that's just a question of fact that we just don't know. But then it sounds like we're heading to court because the White House doesn't want to turn them over and Congress wants them. There is a law that says the IRS shall turn over any individual's tax returns to Congress. That doesn't mean Congress should print them in make them public. But it sounds like we're going to have a legal fight over this.
Mm. But even with that legal fight, it sounds like from what you just said that there are two layers of this. It could be that the Democratic Congress gets Trump's tax returns from this or previous years, but they can't show them to the public?
Yes, because there are privacy rules about that. That doesn't mean they can't look at them and determine that certain things in them merit further investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And those things eventually become public because there's some kind of a hearing about it. But no, I don't think that if down the road, after a long legal fight, Congress gets the tax returns, I don't think they're going to be publishing them. The point is they have to have a reason to get them. They're not saying we just think we should make them public. They're saying we want to get them because it's an important public interest to know where the president has gotten his money, you know, whether he's actually paid his taxes. The other thing about the fight over the tax returns, not unlike the fight over the Mueller report, is it's possible that the Mueller report and the tax returns will not be the kind of, secret weapon that a lot of liberals and Democrats hope they are. We might not find out the answers to a lot of questions about who's financing Trump's businesses from those tax returns.
How
they're going to be in these mm-hmm. in these cutout companies.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be clear who owned them or who the investors are.
Then they need all these sort of forensic accountants to figure out what actually came from where.
Right.
How conflicted is the Democratic leadership over whether this is good strategy headed toward 2020, or if it just makes them look like they're intent on investigating the president rather than trying to offer better policies?
Well, there's always a tension between investigation and legislation, and the Democratic leadership in the House is very aware of that tension and wants to make sure that it's constitutionally required oversight responsibilities are fulfilled, but don't overwhelm their desire to pass legislation, legislation that will not be voted on in the Senate or signed by the president, but legislation that they believe will lay down a marker for 2020 and show what the president, what the Democrats are for and the kinds of things they do if they got the White House back.
And it does seem like the new 2020 approach, I've only been hearing these reports in the last few days, but it makes it sound like a lot of candidates are going there, is showing Trump's promises on manufacturing jobs coming back and things like that, that were supposed to have helped people, you know, economically, mostly in the white working class, to have been empty, those promises, and his policies actually hurting voters. Any idea yet how they'll get specific about that? I guess.
Well, I think you're going to hear that from every Democrat running for president. I think you already have. I think that the Democrats have decided collectively, because of their experience in 2018, that voters don't want to hear all sorts of outrage about how horrible Donald Trump is. They want to hear how Democrats would solve their problems. And voters are much more interested in the kitchen table issues of how are they going to pay for education, health care, retirement, housing, et cetera, than they are in every twist and turn of the Mueller investigation. But I also think that they don't want to hear a lot of complaints about Trump 24 hours a day. That's almost a given. Trump has energized the opposition. Now Democrats have a responsibility to say what they would do if they were in power. I think there's a pretty large consensus on the part of Democrats that that's what they need to do in 2020. Mm-hmm. And also, in terms of saying, look, he promised this to the Rust Belt, it hasn't happened. He promised this to the white working class, it hasn't happened. That means the Democrats have decided that Donald Trump is going to be evaluated for reelection on very traditional criteria. Did he fulfill his promises? Did he make life better for his supporters? Not on whether he's been outrageous and trashed every Democratic norm that he could get his hands on. I mean, that might be true, but that's not what this next election is going to be about.
Speaking of investigations, Attorney General William Barr has promised the Mueller report itself this week with whatever redactions. Any more specifics on the timeline?
No, but we're all on red alert waiting for the report to be dropped. And then there'll be probably a fight over the redactions and a fight over Congress wants to get the underlying investigative materials. So it's hard to imagine that the Democratic House will be happy with what they get from Attorney General Barr. But he has said that he will not be redacting parts of the report about the president, even if the president isn't charged. You know, there was a Department of Justice rule that if somebody isn't being indicted or charged, we shouldn't be releasing investigative material about them. But it sounds like Barr thinks that does not apply to the president.
Fascinating. So are the two parties gearing up for an assumed outcome of whatever vagueness about what Trump may have done that was bad, even though Mueller, we already know, decided not to charge him with anything criminal?
Well, I think the consensus is that there's going to be some damaging negative stuff in the report, even though he didn't find enough evidence that rose to the level of a criminality under conspiracy. Collusion is not a crime. There is no such crime as collusion. That's one of the reasons that President Trump has been talking about it so much, because when he kept on saying no collusion, no collusion, Bob Mueller was not investigating him for collusion. He was investigating him for conspiracy and other actual crimes. So I think both sides are prepared for there to be damaging things in that report, short of evidence that allowed Bob Mueller to bring an indictment against the president or his party. But that's why you see the president treating this entire investigation and report as a political problem, not a legal problem. He spent the last, 2 years or so trying to undermine the credibility of Bob Mueller and the report and the investigation in preparation for Mueller coming out with negative things about him.
Big in the news the last few days has been this Trump line about sending undocumented immigrants to sanctuary cities, including New York, of course, using asylum-seeking families, really, as some kind of retribution against immigration liberals in sanctuary cities. For any of our listeners who followed the news over the weekend, you're probably saturated with the longer version of this clip. So for the sake of those who haven't heard it, here's just 6 seconds of Trump redux on this.
And they want more people in their sanctuary cities? Well, we'll give them more people. We can give them a lot. We can give them an unlimited supply.
So besides the dehumanization of the immigrants or refugees involved there, just using them as pawns for some kind of retribution against liberal cities, I gather from Morning Edition today that there's actually no policy and there's actually no plan, and this would actually be pretty impossible to do.
Might be impossible to do on a practical level. The other thing that's interesting about it is it's kind of a self-own. I know he did this to punish liberals, but the mayors of sanctuary cities that NPR talked to over the weekend said, okay, that's fine. We'll take them. And can you imagine being an immigrant on the border, being told that you're going to a place like San Francisco that welcomes immigrants as opposed to being stuck in a freezing cold detention center on the border? I think they'd be happy about that.
Go ahead and make me a pawn in that case, right? But also, I think The Morning Edition report was a little revelation to me in terms of saying, look, this is where they're all going. This is where so many of the undocumented asylum seekers who are, you know, registering with immigration officials at the border and then being released into the country awaiting their eventual day in court. This is where they're going anyway, because this is where the concentrations of Hondurans and Guatemalans and Salvadorans tend to live
right, and they get a free bus ticket under this policy. Right?
So there's that. So listeners, NPR's Mara Liasson is our first guest, and you can call in on any of the things that we've been talking about so far in national politics or anything else you want to bring up. And on the sanctuary city question, would you want to call up Mayor de Blasio, if you live in New York City, and say, yeah, let's work with the Trump administration to try to do this, because we think basically the more immigrants, the better. They contribute to our economy. They contribute to our culture. This is not criminals. This is, you know, more people doing work that needs to be done and in the tax base, et cetera. Or do you want to say something else to Mayor de Blasio, if you're in any other sanctuary city in our area? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, but it doesn't have to be on that. Julian Assange, Mara, is he coming to the United States to stand trial for encouraging Chelsea Manning to release classified information?
Well, I think the Trump administration is going to try to get him here. There's going to be a long court battle about that, too. Julian Assange, you know, has gone from being kind of a hero of the left for leaking stuff about the Iraq War to being a hero of the right for releasing Hillary Clinton to the DNC, you know, and Clinton officials' emails. So now the U.S. government wants him to put him on trial, and we'll see if they can get him.
Assange worked hard in 2016 to get Trump elected by releasing stolen Democratic Party emails. At the time, Trump said things like this.
Oh, we love WikiLeaks. Boy, they have really WikiLeaks. They have revealed a lot.
So going back to that, before we play the contrasting clip from the other day, how much was Trump not just using WikiLeaks, but also promoting and praising WikiLeaks in 2016? Was that an isolated example that we just played there?
No, I think
there?
The count is he said or tweeted something like that 141 times.
Whoa.
Yes. No, it was a constant refrain. He loved WikiLeaks, as you just heard him say, and he encouraged his supporters to read everything that they were releasing. He was thrilled. Now, what's interesting is back in 2010, of course, when Julian Assange was leaking against the other side, against Republicans, against the Iraq War, he said that Julian Assange should face the death penalty, but his tone really changed when he began running for president, and Assange became a conduit for the Russians, as we learned later, for all these leaked DNC emails. He changed his mind about Assange.
But when Assange was found to be indicted last week and the U.S. asked for extradition from the U.K., Trump said this.
I know nothing about WikiLeaks. It's not my thing. And I know there is something having to do with Julian Assange. I've been seeing what's happened with Assange, and that will be a determination, I would imagine, mostly by the Attorney General.
So is this a case of one-way loyalty?
Well, he says he doesn't know anything about WikiLeaks. The thing that's amazing to me is he has to have known that that would be the trigger for every news organization in the planet to start playing all the clips of him praising WikiLeaks from the campaign. But I think that Trump is so confident that the normal rules and norms don't apply to him, you know, as he famously said, he could stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and not lose any voters, that he feels that he can say, I know nothing about WikiLeaks, just 2 years after he said 141 times how much he loved them.
Yeah. Do you have an opinion about, I realize you're a reporter and analyst, but if you have an opinion about the indictment against Assange being a threat to journalism, I guess the line is that he didn't just publish classified leaked material from the U.S. military. Allegedly, he helped participate in the stealing of it, which I don't think real news organizations do. So is that a line that can give journalists comfort?
You know, I really feel that you should interview a lot of experts on the First Amendment about this, because I'm not sure on that. I do know that the government chose not to charge him under certain statutes that would affect other journalists. They charged him for helping Chelsea Manning to hack into a government computer. And it depends on whether you think Julian Assange is a journalist or not. Now, his lawyers claim that he is.
That he's a publisher, basically.
That he's
right?
a publisher.
Because he doesn't write, but he takes
but,
this
but
material.
But on the other hand, Mike Pompeo, when he was the head of the CIA, said very clearly that the U.S. government considers Assange, I think he said he was a non-state counterintelligence actor. I can't remember the exact phrase, but that they do not consider him a journalist. They consider him a conduit for, you know, Russian intelligence.
And with NPR national political reporter Mara Liasson, Jill in Lower Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Brian, and thanks so much for all of your work. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, with regard to the sanctuary cities and the immigration issue, whether there might be some kind of TPS program, temporary protected status for the asylum seekers, and if there would be a way from Central America, a way to create a program linking agricultural workers from this region, since there's a lot of climate change migration that's affecting particular Honduran farmers with areas in this country where we have a dearth of agricultural workers thanks to the draconian immigration program of our current administration. And that's what I wanted to say.
Thank you. Mara, any thought about
that? Those things would be part of a negotiation between the White House and Congress on a comprehensive immigration reform plan. There are a lot of people in Washington who are talking about the need for more agricultural workers, for more high-skilled workers. We also need low-skilled workers. The fastest-growing occupation in America right now is home health aide, and most of those jobs are done by immigrant women. And so those are the kinds of things that you'd think the White House and Congress would want to discuss. But the last time the president tried to make a larger immigration deal with Democrats, it was mostly about getting a fair amount of money for the wall in exchange for giving legal status to some of the Dreamers. It fell apart because he later in the negotiations decided to ask for policies that would decrease legal immigration by about 44%. And those talks fell apart, and they really haven't been revived ever since. But I think that shows you that, you know, Congress and the White House need to solve this problem in a comprehensive way, and that's not what's happening now.
Nancy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I think this thing about de Blasio and the Daily News, when they brought out that headline, let me have everybody in, this is like, we need a well-thought-out plan, and the Democrats have to come out with it, because it's like the borders are, let me turn the radio down.
Yeah, I think you're getting the seven-second delay in your ear. Go ahead.
Okay, hello.
Yeah.
They need a well-thought-out. I don't hear the Democrats coming out with, Okay, so what should we do with this problem, immigrant problem down there? It's going to be like Merkel saying, okay, take everybody into the European Union, and look at what's happened. It's really a mess. You know, the people weren't ready for it. We need a well-thought-out plan, and the Democrats have to come up to the plate. And de Blasio should not be taking just people in. And my brother is very conservative, and I've heard from conservatives. They want everybody in. They want to take in the drug addicts. And we've got to make a well-thought-out plan.
Nancy, thanks.
You know, that's...
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think she really put her finger on the nose of the Democrats' problem. If the debate is about putting kids in cages, building a wall, shutting down the border, the president loses. If the debate is about border security and an actual solution to the problems on the border, the Democrats are on the defensive and could lose. In other words, a lot of things that Donald Trump does around the border, people don't like, but they do want the border situation solved. And even though illegal crossings are at a mere fraction of what they were in 2000, they have really spiked up, you know, 50%, 75%, 100% over where they were just last year. So the Democrats have to be for something. And they do. They have had plans in the past. Comprehensive immigration reform, a path to legalization for certain numbers of the illegal immigrants already here, what they want to do about asylum, how would they change it? Would they tighten up the rules for asylum the way the president wants, or would they define them somehow differently? But yes, I do think that Democrats have to have a border plan.
Chris in Summit, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Brian. I had a thought this morning in the wee hours. I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if we took all these people into sanctuary cities and then we made sure that they all got census forms.
So that the states with the sanctuary cities would have more people counted in the census and then we would get more representation in Congress.
Yeah, I don't think Trump thought beyond square one.
Chris, thank you very much. That's very clever and diabolical. And it actually makes me think of another question, Mara, which is what's the status of Trump's plan to thwart Chris from Summit, even though he doesn't know Chris from Summit, by not allowing people who aren't or by requiring a citizenship question on the census, which is thought to be a way to discourage a lot of people in liberal cities from
in court right
being
now.
Counted.
Right. That's in court right now. The census, of course, says you should count every person, not every citizen. And there's been a big controversy over whether the Secretary of Commerce, because Wilbur Ross, that's where the census is conducted in his agency, asked for a citizenship question on the form. So that's still being litigated. But it's really interesting because the idea that immigrants only go to blue states is just not true. When you look at that map of where asylum seekers end up while they're waiting for their court date, a lot of them go to Houston. You know, a lot of them go to Texas. Mm-hmm. Some of them go to Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
So undocumented immigrants or people who aren't legal residents or people who aren't citizens are everywhere.
The Ilhan Omar and Trump and New York Post controversy. I want to play the fuller version of what Congresswoman Omar said that Trump took out of context to paste into an image of the burning World Trade Center that he tweeted. Here she is speaking to the Council on Islamic American Relations, CARE, a Muslim American civil rights group, about the origins of that group as she was describing them.
Far too long, we have lived with the discomfort of being a second-class citizen. And frankly, I'm tired of it, and every single Muslim in this country should be tired of it. CARE was founded after 9/11 because they recognized that some people did something and that all of us were starting to lose access to our civil liberties.
So what was taken out of that was some people did something, referring to the 9/11 attacks, and some people are more offended by her referring to the 9/11 attacks as simply some people did something in making a point about discrimination against Muslim Americans as a group for that. And some are more offended by Trump tweeting an image of the burning World Trade Center in response, or the New York Post putting that on the front page. One of the local stories here, Mara, is the Yemeni American Business Association, which represents about half of all the bodega owners in New York City, like 5,000 bodega owners, say they won't carry the New York Post anymore because they put that inflammatory image on the cover. So where does this have to go as a political issue in Washington?
Well, first of all, just a small fact check on Ilhan Omar's statement. CARE was not founded after 9/11. It was founded in 1994. But this has become another weaponized piece of tape for Donald Trump and his supporters. Some people did something to them, shows that she was dismissive in their mind of 9/11. Somehow she was downplaying its importance. But they have now tried in the videotape that Donald Trump tweeted to connect her to the attack as if she was condoning it. And she says that in response to this, she's gotten her the number of death threats that she's been getting has spiked. And once again, we're in a kind of tribalized, weaponized political conversation. And where does this go? Nowhere good, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, she has been chosen as somebody like Nancy Pelosi used to be that can be the kind of she's a Muslim, she's a woman, she can be made into the scary face of the Democratic Party as far as Trump and his supporters are concerned. And just like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is mentioned thousands of times a week on Fox, now Ilhan Omar has become the poster child for everything they want voters to hate and fear about the left.
And we should say, though I don't have the clip, Gerald Nadler, the congressman from New York who represents the district that includes the World Trade Center, went on TV yesterday, I think it was CNN State of the Union, and said that he doesn't have any problem with what he said. As the, you know, the congressman from the World Trade Center, he understood the context and he did not feel that she was dismissing. So I don't know if there are any Gerald Nadler politics there. But
yes, well, most Democrats have been supportive of Omar in this instance. In the past, when she's made remarks that other Democrats have considered to be anti-Semitic, they've called her out, and there's been a lot of controversy inside the Democratic caucus about that. But, you know, what's interesting is there's always a tweet and there's always tape. And this, of course, prompted some journalists to go back and get the tape of Donald Trump on 9/11 talking about how the destruction of the Twin Towers meant that his building was now the tallest in New York. Those were the things that he was saying, you know, right after the attack.
Wow, he said that? I never heard that one. Incredible.
Yes, yes. In addition to during the campaign, he said that Muslims in New Jersey were celebrating where nobody could have ever found any evidence of that.
Right. And so is there... I do understand that there's also some dissatisfaction by some of the new freshman members of Congress, including Omar. I don't want to put words in her mouth. Enough people are taking her out of context. But Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, talking about the Democratic Party using them as tokens to say how diverse they are without actually listening to their policy concerns or taking them seriously. How serious is that risk?
I don't see that. I see those three people getting disproportionate amount of press coverage. And as far as their tokens for diversity, my goodness, the Democratic caucus in Congress is very diverse. Not just, and they aren't the only women of color in the caucus. There's a lot more. So I don't know why they would say that.
One more on the sanctuary cities offer, threat, call it what you will, from Trump. Jim in the South Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Brian, you'll remember that some weeks ago, or maybe a few months ago, you had former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper on your show.
Right.
And among the things you talked about, or he talked about with you, is Canadian immigration policy, which is very sort of open. But he pointed out that unless immigration is legal, and controlled, that you will destroy any public consensus in favor of immigration. And I think progressives really have to understand that some of their policies and rhetoric really undermine the very principles they're trying to promote. And I think they really have to grapple with that.
And come up with a policy.
I totally agree with that. I mean, if the debate, like I said before, if the debate is about Donald Trump is for border security and Democrats are for open borders, Democrats lose. If Democrats are for comprehensive immigration reform, where you'd have legal, controlled immigration, a strong border, but you have a way to deal with the 11 million people here illegally now, a way to satisfy the United States' needs for workers. We're facing a looming labor shortage. It's exactly the opposite of what the president said the other day when he said, we're full, we can't take anymore. In fact, we are facing a looming labor shortage. But yes, I think if Democrats become the party that says we shouldn't have any borders, everyone should come here, then I think that's a loser politically.
Yes, although one thing about Harper and the Canadian policy in general is that they're very open to refugees. And this is a different kind of immigrant influx that's taking place at the border now, with it being primarily people who say they're seeking political asylum in the United States, which is different than just people trying to sneak in so they can get jobs, you know, beyond the quota.
Right. And that's why Trump says that he doesn't believe the asylum seekers. He's mocked them, you know, saying when they say they're afraid for their life, it's just a scam. But when he cuts aid to Central America, that can have the actual opposite effect of what he wants. Instead of punishing these countries for allowing their citizens to migrate to our southern border, it could actually cause more people in those countries to flee.
Yeah. So last question, and this is maybe a little conspiratorial, but, you know, the number of people coming from anywhere in Latin America during Obama was much lower, ironically, than it is now during Trump, who makes such a show of being so anti-immigrant, and he's cutting off aid to the three Central American Northern Triangle countries, which presumably, or at least some people say, could encourage more people to flee for here because things will be even worse. Or I heard a version that says because he keeps threatening to close the border without doing it, that's causing more people to rush here right now before he does it. I wonder if Trump, rather than actually want to see fewer migrants coming to the border, would like to see more as something that he could use as, you know, a cudgel in the 2020 reelection campaign.
No. Too conspiratorial. Look, Donald Trump definitely wants to weaponize immigration. That's his go-to issue. And he likes to have the optics and the images of people crossing the border to point to them and say, look, we have a crisis. However, he's where we started this conversation. He's going to be judged on his record. He said he'd keep the border secure. If there are huge surges in immigrants on the border, that's not good for him. And he's facing, you know, several months of increased numbers of asylum seekers and illegal crossers. So he doesn't want that. I don't think he wants the situation to get worse just so he can say, look, I told you it was a crisis. He wants to solve the problem. He's been frustrated because a lot of the things that he's asked the Department of Homeland Security to do have not been done, some of them because the officials he recently fired said it's not legal to do those things. So now he's trying all sorts of other things without having a real policy process that vets them, like cutting off aid to Central America. And none of them seem to work.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.